Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to the Start Me Up podcast, part of the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. I'm Kimberly, fully vaccinated Johnson in D.C. Today, my returning guest is anti-racism educator Tim Wise. I'm really looking forward to talking to him. But before we start with the show, I do try to keep these intros short. I have a tier on Patreon, though, that allows listeners to listen ad-free and with a much shorter intro. The Start Me Up podcast is an independent podcast supported by listeners, and it's woman-run. It's patrons who keep the show going, and I'm so grateful. If you do enjoy today's show, take a look at the About page, check out some of my past guests. Most of the time, I talk to political people. Sometimes I talk to actors, because I used to be one. But just visit patreon.com/startmeup. I do two free shows a week on Mondays and Wednesdays, and they're followed up by the What's Up show, which is just me alone talking about whatever I feel like, kind of like an online diary. I also do one patrons-only show with a guest once a month. Just check out the variety of tier options at patreon.com/startmeup. You can make a one-time donation by checking out the text in the Patreon description. I've included a link that makes it easy to donate through PayPal. You can find Start Me Up on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever podcasts are found. Just stop by the iTunes app, Apple Podcast Store, become a subscriber. It's free. And while you're there, if you like the show, please rate it and leave a review. I would really appreciate it. Now, please enjoy my conversation with Tim Wise. Welcome back to the show, Tim.
Hey, thank you so much for having me back.
Well, you're an important person to talk to right now, considering what you do for a living and what you're known for. You are an anti-racist educator, and right now our country is freaking out. I mean, we're just like freaking out. And I mean, I think we've been freaking out for a long time, but it's really gotten bad since Trump. And before we start the show, you were on the show before and you talked about your upbringing and the fact that you went to school. You're a white guy and you went to school with African-American students. Primarily, that was the more African-American than white people. So I just want you to kind of go over that a little, introduce yourself to everybody so that they understand where you're coming from.
Sure. Well, let me clarify first off. Okay. I'm from Nashville, Tennessee. I grew up here, which is where I live again now. And growing up, I did my very first, you know, educational experience was preschool, as it is for a lot of kids. But I think the difference for me, and this would have been in 1972 when I was like 3.5 years old or whatever, 1973 when I was 4.5, you know, was going to preschool at a historically black college preschool program there. So I was in the early childhood ed program at Tennessee State University, which was on the other side of town from where I lived, but where my mom really wanted me to go to preschool. And as I joke about it, you know, on the one hand, yeah, it was because she wanted me to have an integrated, not only integrated, but really an experience where I would not be the norm. Like she had the, you know, the foresight to realize the importance of that. And she also wanted to piss off her parents. So there is that part too, you know, it wasn't all nobility. There was some of that too, but, and then I went to public school in Nashville from 1974 to 1986. They were not majority black schools, but they were, you know, 40%. Probably, I think at one point, like junior high, what we now call middle school, is probably 45% black kids. So it's about half and half, maybe more like 35 to 38% in high school. But yeah, always very, you know, integrated environments. I played ball on you know, ball teams where I was one of only a handful of white kids on the team, and it was really important. And I bring that up not in the way that I think a lot of white folks do when they talk about like, oh, I've got black friends or I hung out with black people. Like, that's not what I mean by it, because every white person will tell you they have black friends and we're usually bullshitting. Like, it's usually not real, right? Like, to the point where we can't actually name them, like first and last name. They're not in our speed dial, you know, so they're not really that close to us usually. But for me, that was literally like my entire friend base, with the exception of one or two people in those early years of school, were Black kids, because that was just sort of who I identified with. And I'm sure that was about going to TSU for preschool. And so, you know, being on those ball teams, and I may have told you this story last time, I've told it many times before, but it's worth repeating, you know, that when I was like 11 or 12, playing baseball, which was sort of my sport, because I thought it was going to be basketball. And then, you know, I topped out at 5'8", and I was like, all right, that's it. Clearly, I'm done with that shit. I better find a different form of athleticism. But when I was like 12, you know, we went out to play a scrimmage game about 30 minutes outside of Nashville. And the team was like me, two other white guys, and the rest of the kids were Black kids. And we showed up, and this team out in this sort of semi-rural, that in those days it would have been very rural, now it's more of like a exurb, but you know, they were just like, yeah, we're not going to play you. I mean, they just refused to play us because it was a quote-unquote Black team, and this is 1980, not 1950, you know. And they surrounded our car as we turned to leave, and we're calling the Black kids the N-word and calling the white kids and the white coach, you know, N-word lover, and all those kind of things. And it was one of those really defining moments where you start to realize that there is this line that someone has drawn. Mm-hmm. You didn't draw it, and mm-hmm. your friends didn't draw it, but someone has drawn it, and these kids are letting you know, as a white person, letting me and the other white folks in the car know, you have crossed a line. You have transgressed against this club, and we are going to strive to not only injure your Black friends, but to injure you, whether it's physically or emotionally. I mean, it was, you know, it was a very formidable thing. And the reason I tell the story is I think sometimes, you know, if you come to your anti-racism, as I think some white folks do, through, you know, the classes they take in college mm-hmm. or the books they read as adults, which is fine. Like, whatever gets you there is great. But I think sometimes to actually see the bullshit, like to see it and to understand what the system of white supremacy does, not only to Black and brown folks as the targets, but even the damage that it does to white folks, so that they do that kind of bullshit that those kids and their coaches did. Mm-hmm. Like, white supremacy did that to them too, right? Yeah. It warped their thinking too. White supremacy led 6 out of 10 white people in Louisiana, when I lived there, to vote for a Nazi, David Duke, when he ran for the U.S. Senate. White supremacy did that. And when you see that, it's not about the critical race theory class that you took in college, or it's not about the, oh God, I read this amazing book by Ibram Kendi. Okay, cool, fantastic. But the stuff that you see and that you can feel yourself is 10 times more powerful than whatever scholarship you can ingest.
Just FYI, everybody, we had a little bit of a weird experience with a number calling me, and it's a long story, but I just had to like unplug for a minute, and we're back. So, okay. Now, I want to talk to you about white supremacy, because it's something that it's always been around, as you were talking about. It's nothing new, but it certainly has exploded. And I'm just wondering, you know, what are your thoughts on where this country is headed and where you genuinely believe it's going to go? Because there's white supremacists in power. Trump was a white supremacist. And I'm really frightened about the future of our government and how white supremacy plays into that. So, like, what do you see happening in the future with elections and all of it?
Well, I mean, first, just for the sake of clarity, you know, white supremacy as an ideology and as sort of a systemic reality has been baked in, you know, to the country, obviously, from its inception. I mm-hmm. mean, going back to the colonial period, but even if we just look at the country itself, you know, the very first law that was passed by the Congress after the Constitution was ratified. So they, you know, they go into session, the Constitution is now ratified. The very first thing they do, before they raise money, before they figure out the army situation, before they do anything, mm-hmm. before they, like, you know, pass a resolution to congratulate themselves on this new nation, like, before anything, the first thing they did was pass this law called the Naturalization Act of 1790, which said that all free white persons and only free white persons could be citizens. So mm-hmm. basically what they were saying is, the most important thing that we can do right now is to let everybody know that whiteness is synonymous with citizenship and exclusive to citizenship. Mm-hmm. And so in that regard, white supremacy, obviously nothing new. Mm-hmm. White supremacy has been part of the system from the beginning. Now the difference between, you know, 230 plus years or so and where we are now is that we're in a position where, for the first time, really, whiteness itself as this sort of dominant hegemonic cultural behemoth is really being challenged. Obviously, mm-hmm. there have been challenges before to various versions of white supremacy. So the mm-hmm. abolitionist movement challenged enslavement, which was one iteration of white supremacy. The civil rights movement challenged Jim Crow segregation, which was another iteration of white supremacy. But in the post-civil rights era, there's been this much more nuanced, slick, what Ian Haney Lopez calls dog whistle politics version of white supremacy, mm-hmm. which is, you know, we're still doing racist shit, but we're just using language that sort of obfuscates that. And for 30, 40 years, you know, that worked. And what's happened in this, you know, you begin to see this when Obama is elected, that there is this existential meltdown in parts of white America mm-hmm. that really had nothing to do with Obama's agenda, because let's be honest, Obama was not about really fundamentally revolutionizing anything in the United States at all. He was just trying to get some folks some health care and not even like really radical health care. I mean, you know, just some basic stuff that used to be Mitt Romney's idea, for God's sake. But the fact that here was a black guy with a quote unquote exotic name mm-hmm. and a different kind of background. You know, he grew up in Hawaii, you know, and a lot of white folks think that's just like a vacation destination. They still aren't clear that it's a state, you know. So you got a black guy with a funny name and a different kind of background coming to power at a time when the economy happens to be melting down. And mm-hmm. so for the first time in 80 years, white America is looking at double digit unemployment. We had not dealt with that since the Depression. Black folks, brown folks, sure, that was every day.
Yeah.
But for white folks, like, that was really new. And then at the same time, you have the popular culture beginning to obviously shift, you know, in a very multicultural mm-hmm. direction. I mean, our popular culture, entertainment, everything about our popular culture is thoroughly interwoven now.
Yeah.
And if you've grown up in a popular culture where all the icons sort of look like you, you know, the music your kids mm-hmm. listen to was music that, even if you didn't like it, they looked like you, you know, the athletes sort of look like you, or what, you could identify with all the, you know, pop culture icons. And now popular culture is multicultural and interwoven. The political system is being led by the black guy. The economy's melting down. Oh, and by the way, the demographic shift is so significant that within 30 years, white folks will no longer be an absolute majority. All that was happening at once, mm-hmm. and it created this anxiety in white folks, which I wrote about in my book, Dear White America, during all the Tea Party stuff, that sort of prefaced the Trump movement and the MAGA movement, right? And so what I think we're seeing, what makes white supremacy unique right now, again, it's not unique, it's mm-hmm, been here for hundreds of years, but what makes it uniquely dangerous is that, unlike any other point in that hundreds of years process, whiteness is actually being made visible for the first time. We're actually naming it, right? Mm-hmm, we're shining mm-hmm. a light on it. We're problematizing it. Mm-hmm. It's no longer, you know, the old saying used to be, you know, being white means never having to think about it. And that was true for like hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. But now, if the culture is shifting and you're having to share the designation of what it means to be an American with people that don't look like you and don't pray like you and, you know, have different cultural traditions than you, then all of a sudden pluralism is encroaching on your ability to be like the floor model of the all-American boy or girl, right? Like if I said all-American boy or girl 30 years ago, we all know what everybody is.
Right,
And when I say everybody, I don't even mean just white people. I mean, even black and brown folks have been like, oh, that's some white blonde in Kansas.
Yeah.
You know, like that would have been the prototype. And yet now you know you use those terms and that might not be
mm-hmm.
you know, you might think of a Latina in Albuquerque, you mm-hmm. might think of someone who's Hmong American in the Twin Cities, who are every bit as American as everyone else, and that to some people is incredibly threatening.
Yeah.
And so where it leads from here is a very open question, because what we are now up against is not just sort of right versus left. It's certainly not just Democrat versus Republican. it's not just sort of the elite against the masses, right? What it is this battle between multicultural pluralism and democracy, small d democracy, as opposed to sort of implicit white nationalism and you know, semi-authoritarianism, because the only way really that you can stave off the changes that are happening is with authoritarian tactics. You know, the demographic shift cannot be changed or stopped by anything other than incredibly draconian measures. And I'm talking like way beyond the wall at the border. Like the people that are anti-immigrant who think, oh, if we just build the wall, we can keep all these brown people from sworn. Look, the demographic shift that everybody's all nervous about, where white folks are gonna, you know, no longer be the dominant majority, that's gonna happen even if not one more immigrant came in, brown immigrant came into this country. The reason that's happening is because the median age for white women is 43. And 43-year-old white women just don't have a lot of babies. It's just a fact, right? Whereas the median age for Latinas, and I'm not talking about undocumented Latinas, I'm talking about citizens, is like 29. And the median age for black women is like 34. And 29 and 34, and the median for Asian women is like 37. And and women 37 and below have a lot more babies than women 43 and older. So it's done. Like white folks, it's done. Pack it in. Like, this is not going to be a majority white nation unless you want to get behind literally putting people on cattle cars and deporting them or exterminating them. Like, that is, it is literally a battle between those who believe in letting go and allowing this to become a multicultural pluralistic democracy or imposing like birth restrictions on brown people and subsidizing white people to have babies, which, you know, the last person that did that was Hitler. So, you know, great. You know, you can create eugenic programs and sterilization programs. That's it. Like, that's the only other option. So it is a choice between fascism and democracy. It's that stark. And I don't know which way it's going to go. I do know that I don't expect white folks to go quietly into a more pluralistic, you know, functioning democracy. I hope I'm wrong, but we just need to understand that's, those are our choices now.
How much difference do you think it makes to have this like very diverse nation and then within the pop culture, the acceptance and absolute, you know, just integration of everybody, and then having a country that is run in a, you know, white supremacist, fascist kind of ideology? I mean, because I wonder about that. You know, I mean, as I grew up, and I talk about this all the time, when I grew up, it was Sesame Street, it was Electric Company, and it was diversity and free to be you and me. And I was always under the impression that we were just going to continue to be diverse, that we were going to see women presidents, we were going to see black women presidents. And then, of course, now things are going in an opposite direction politically. But like you're saying, in pop culture, it's very diverse. So how does that, I mean, I guess... And I'm asking this in a way because on one hand, I feel like the answer is, well, if you have fascists running everything, then we are going to see some of those things, whether it's, you know, we're not going to see ovens again, but we will see the equivalent, like the contemporary equivalent. They'll figure out something that's going to be just as horrible. And because I had the opportunity to live in Soviet Russia and I got to see an entire nation petrified of saying anything, so they said nothing. Like, I mean, do you see that because the American people have had a certain experience for a certain amount of time and we're all used to it, and then if that gets taken away or changed over, do you think that we would just become like, not Soviet Russia, but in that we would become like the Russians who just said nothing because they were too afraid?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there's always been that tendency here, you know. I mean, the Soviets got to a point where they didn't really have to send anyone, you know, to Siberia anymore. They didn't really have to send people to the Gulag anymore. You know, it was like people were just cowed, right? And I remember, look, that tendency has been here. I remember even in the 80s, you know, doing various activist work around, you know, U.S. policy in Central America or South Africa or whatever. And we would have petitions for people to sign. And there were always those people who were like, oh, I don't want my name on a list, you know, because they're going to come after me. Right. And so that fear has always been there, but I think it's probably ramped up even more now because of the, you know, of the sort of the surveillance age that we're in. Right. Mm-hmm. So people are really nervous. Now, some people clearly not nervous enough about getting caught. So the insurrectionists are putting their shit out in the street, you know, and being like, woohoo, I was at the Capitol on January 6th, come and get me. And then they come and get you, you know, but I mean, I get it. Right. But I think what is likely here is that we are going to see an increasing kind of circle the wagons mentality among a certain group of white people. And it's going to be those who are, you know, disproportionately those who were older. I mean, they are the ones who were having the hardest time with the adaptation, because they're the ones who still can nostalgically recall the pre-civil rights era, right? Mm-hmm. They're the ones who can actually say MAGA and not be like ironic, right? Yeah. Like I mean, someone who's 23 wearing a MAGA hat is like, what are you talking about? Make America great again, like what? Like your junior prom? Like what are you like really and truly, what are you even hearkening back to? But if you're 75, right? Mm-hmm. If you're 80, you're somebody who maybe you remember, you know, oh, I remember sock hops and drive-in movies and hula hoops and shit like that. I remember when the Beatles came to America and it was so exciting. Like, you're not necessarily thinking, oh, I really want to go back to segregation, but you're nostalgically able to just ignore how terrible that period was for millions of your fellow countrymen and women. And so in that regard, what we see in this country has always been sort of a split personality of people who can embrace the culture, the multiculture, but not really embrace the idea of power sharing. Right. And that's always been the divide. Because if you think about it, like, what was the most popular style of music by the late 30s or mid 40s? It was jazz. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it was, you know, black music, black sort of artists have always been on the cutting edge and have always been accepted long before black bosses have been and black bankers and black lawyers and black doctors and black presidents and you know, black boards of directors or black neighbors for that matter, right? Like it's always easier to, oh, I can cheer for this athlete or I can really be into this type of music, but boy, you know, if I have to really share power, that's the distinction. And so that's always been the split. And I think for some younger folks who grew up, and when I say younger now, I mean anything, you know, maybe, I don't know, 35 and younger, maybe even 40 and younger, there is, and certainly, you know, 30 and below, who came up in a much more multicultural space, it certainly tends to bode well. I mean, in and of itself, it is a good thing. But the danger of it, and this is what we sometimes overlook, is that it is really easy, if you came up in a culturally pluralistic way of thinking, to assume that the rest will take care of itself, right? To think that, well, because I have these black friends, and maybe you really do have them, maybe you're not the person who's bullshitting, like I said earlier, maybe you really do, or maybe you really do just love black, you know, music and culture and blah, 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 whatever. But if you assume that that's going to lead to real multicultural democracy, and you're not thinking about the power dynamics that continue to skew the justice system, the school system, the housing market, the job market, then you're going to be in real trouble. So some of the cultural democracy, the more small d democratic culture stuff, can be helpful. Sometimes it can also cloud our vision. And so we have to be able to distinguish between cultural pluralism and economic and political pluralism, because they're not the same thing.
Wow. Well, you know, you wrote a thread on Twitter about race-neutral policies, and I want to get to that. But first, we're going to take a quick commercial break. There's so much going on in the world that can make it difficult to relax and decompress. You've experienced the Sunday scaries, that feeling of dread in the pit of your stomach that comes on Sunday afternoons. Now, here's a totally different Sunday scaries, vitamin-boosted CBD gummies. And you don't even have to wait until Sunday night rolls around. Self-care is so important, and Sunday scaries is here to help. Sunday scaries believes that everyone deserves a hand on a difficult day. So if you're looking for a way to decompress, Sunday Scaries has you covered with their CBD products. Visit SundayScaries.com and use the promo code SEXYLIBERAL, all one word, at the checkout and get 25% off your order. That's 25% off at SundayScaries.com with promo code SEXYLIBERAL. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. These products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. These products are not for use by sale or to persons under the age of 18. All right, and we're back. Okay, so you wrote a long thread, so I just kind of want you to go off on this, but the first thing that you wrote was people rarely think about all the ways that race-neutral, normal, everyday policies and practices perpetuate and help deepen racial disparities in this country, but they should, because this is too... Okay, wait a minute. Because this, too, is a large part of what we mean by systematic racism. So let's dig into this. Explain it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are using the term systemic racism. Sometimes those of us in the anti-racism community obviously use it. Also, those who are critics of those in the anti-racism community use the term and usually, you know, make fun of the term or dismiss the term, mm-hmm. but they use it. And so there's a lot of people using it. And I don't think sometimes we define it. And even those of us on the left and in the anti-racism community don't do a good enough job of really describing what it is. So I try in a lot of my social media stuff and other, you know, pieces that I write on Medium and other places to sort of delve into what at least what I mean by it. I can't speak for everyone else.
Right.
But for me, one of the, you know, best ways to conceptualize systemic racism is to distinguish it from the much more deliberate, intentional, individual-driven racism that we tend to think of when mm-hmm. we think of racism. And so when I think of systemic racism, I think of the sedimented inequality that stems from a series of policies and practices and procedures which are fully normalized in our society and that we never or at least rarely question, which may not even have any and probably don't have any deliberate racist intent. Mm-hmm. And they may be colorblind in the sense that they don't even speak to race. They don't specify anything about race, but they very clearly have predictable, foreseeable, mm-hmm. racially disparate consequences. And if we understand those policies as institutional racism, which then becomes sedimented throughout the system, then we understand what systemic racism is. So in the thread, which I ended up not completing because I got distracted, I need to probably get back to it, but I talked about how this works in employment and schools and housing in particular. And so in employment, you know, it's one thing to talk about implicit bias and microaggressions and stereotypes and overt hostility and all that stuff is real. But there's some other things that are at least as important in terms of how people get jobs in this country. And so the two main ways people get jobs are either through networking and connections, which are obviously racially disparate. They're mm-hmm. also gender disparate and class disparate mm-hmm. because the best networks are going to be overwhelmingly upper middle class and above white guys, whether they're really the most qualified and capable or not. They're, right. they're the ones who are going to know the people who can write letters and put in a good word. And there's been plenty of evidence of that. And there's nothing you can do about that, by the way. You can't outlaw the old boys network, yeah. obviously. You're not going to be able to pass a law to prohibit people from, you know, telling their neighbor, hey, Jim, you know, there's this great job at my company. You might want to apply. But that's why we need DEI and affirmative action efforts to balance that out, mm-hmm. right? It's like that's going to be there, but you want to be able to make deliberate efforts at inclusion to counteract that.
Yes.
And unfortunately, the right just wants to attack the counteracting but not deal with the original mm-hmm. problem, right? Mm-hmm. And then the second thing, when you know, if you're not getting a job through networks and connections, you're getting it supposedly the old-fashioned way of, you know, I had the best resume, mm-hmm. I was the most qualified, I had the most experience. But let's be honest, in a society of unequal outcomes and opportunity in the past, and in a society of profound inequity where some have had advantages historically, and no rational person denies that, those who have had a head start ought to hit the tape first, so to speak, mm-hmm. to use a racing analogy. So if I've had a 3-lap head start on you in a 5-lap race, I'm supposed to cross the finish line first. Doesn't mean I'm the fastest runner. By the same token, if I've had, you know, opportunities in the job market that you haven't had, my resume ought to look better than yours, mm-hmm. but it doesn't mean that I'm necessarily more qualified. So employers need to be much more deliberate about thinking critically mm-hmm. about the credentials that they see on when applicants apply for jobs. Because a lot of times, if you don't do that, you're going to recreate an inequity.
Yeah.
You're going to recreate unfair treatment, even though you didn't mean to. Doesn't mean you're a racist in the overt sense, but mm-hmm. you're engaging in a policy that perpetuates inequity. In housing, a good example, you know, is, you know, people will say, well, the reason that, you know, black folks are turned down for mortgages more often, or they get higher interest rates, is because their credit score are not as good, or their credit history is not as good. Okay, well, putting that aside, and I make a point in the thread that, you know, actually there's some evidence that even black folks with better credit get worse rates, or they're turned mm-hmm. down at a higher rate. But put that aside and just think about what goes into credit scores and what doesn't. How do people get credit? You know, when I was 18 years old, my mom put me on one of her credit cards as a co-signatory, and I had access to the card. I couldn't use it much. I mean, she put me on a pretty short leash, but mm-hmm. she said, like, you know, but you can use this a little bit. And I did. And that helped. And then she paid the bill mm-hmm. and that helped me build up a credit history, which I then totally screwed up later because I'm bad with credit. My wife ultimately had to fix my credit by, you know, being the one who paid all the bills,
right.
But I had that early credit, and a lot of white folks I knew, mm-hmm. their parents did that for them. The black friends that I had, like, their parents didn't do that. And it wasn't because they didn't have the money to do it or whatever. It was because they're like, credit is a trap. Don't get a credit card.
Yeah.
It's 18% interest.
That's, right,
you know,
yeah.
they're trying to rope you in and screw you. And they were right. Like,
yes.
The black parents were actually smarter
yeah.
than my mom, in a sense, and way smarter than me. But the problem is, if you don't establish credit early on,
yeah.
now when you try to go get a house, they're like, well, you don't have a credit history.
Right.
Or and the even bigger thing is, you know, the only stuff that goes into your credit history is actual commercial credit, which may seem obvious, and you may be like, well, yeah, no shit. But here's the problem. There are a lot of things that black and brown folks, and working class white folks too, for that matter, because there's a class element to this, that they do have, unlike a credit card maybe. They, you know, they have a phone bill, they have a cable bill, they have a internet bill, they have a water bill, they have utilities,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, previous rent, and none of that stuff goes into
wow.
your credit score.
Yeah.
So you could be paying all your bills on time. You could
mm-hmm.
have a really good record of doing that and making, but none of that's going to help you. And so when you go to get a mortgage, they're like, yeah, you're too big a risk. And so a lot of black and brown folks, it's not because the bankers necessarily are racist. They might be,
mm-hmm.
but they could be totally not a racist, just using this normal procedure. And
yeah.
it's going to work to the detriment of folks of color. Education, you know, obviously, you know, using standardized tests on unstandardized students with unstandardized curriculum and access to resources is going to perpetuate racial inequity. You can think of similar examples in the justice system. I mean, the point being, we need to think about the way that a lot of the stuff we do every single day in these various areas perpetuates racial injustice. And that is what we mean by systemic racism. It doesn't require bigotry. It doesn't require bias, conscious or unconscious. We could get rid of all the personal bias in the world. And if we didn't interrogate these seemingly race-neutral practices and realize what it means to operate those in a racially skewed society, it'd be
mm-hmm.
one thing if we'd all started out equal. Like, if we'd all started out truly with equal opportunity, maybe this wouldn't be such a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have a system that is already structured on the basis of inequality, and then you take these practices and you lay them on top of that society,
mm-hmm.
you will perpetuate that injustice. That is what systemic racism is.
Wow. It's just so, you know, it's interesting because I like to watch and I'm almost embarrassed to admit this, but I've admitted it before, but I like to watch The Real Housewives, like three shows particular. And,
oh, yeah,
and
we watch that. My wife and I, that's our thing, too. We watch it. I can admit it to you now because you've admitted it first. Yeah.
No. And I mean,
but wait, which ones do you like?
I
don't like all of them.
No, me neither. I watch The OC and I watch New Jersey and Beverly
yeah.
Hills. Now,
yeah.
I will say that in all of those shows, first of all, I have noticed that most of the time, they're all white people, with the exception of, oh God, Atlanta, which is primarily black.
Well, Atlanta and Bethesda, yeah, the DC one.
Right.
The,
yes. Yeah. So they have more more diversity. Although, it's a little embarrassing, but I can't help it. And part of the reason I watch it, though, especially like with the OC, the patriarchy is just so evident and on display. So I don't watch it because I'm like, ooh, it's just so fun. It is fun. And it's like eating Cheetos. You know, it's like the equivalent of eating Cheetos. There's no nutrition in it. But for me, it's just junk food. But there's also this, I don't know, there's something I take from it. You know, like, for instance, in the Beverly Hills, which I'm going to bring up in a second, I want to talk about, there's a black woman on Beverly Hills, and she did something last night. But, it was last week. Anyway, so there was a fundraiser. Somebody did a fundraiser, and all the women showed up, and they were all wearing ridiculously expensive outfits. I mean, $10,000 to $15,000. And so I'm grateful that they're giving money to these charities, but it's just so sickening to me to see them comparing outfits that are like, mine's $20,000, and they don't necessarily say the price, but you know that they're so expensive, and it's just so gross. So anyway, and I don't remember either one of their names, but there were two women on a show. I watch it on Sunday. So there were two women. Yeah. One is white, one is black. And so I guess at the end of last season, they did the reunion show. And on the reunion show, the white woman had basically, the black woman and white woman got in a fight and some argument or whatever. And so the white woman said, hey, we had this fundraiser and you raised up your thing and you were going to pay us $5,000 or whatever. And then we never got the payment. Right. And so this season they got together and they were at a restaurant, and the black woman was like, okay, first of all, you know, they talked about it, and it was evident that the black woman, there was a reason she didn't pay, and it was just because there was a mistake with an address or something, and that had to be worked out. Once that was worked out, she did what she said she was going to do and give money to this charity. So she asked the white woman, would you ask this of black women? And of course, the look on the white woman's face was like, oh my God, I can't believe you asked me that. And then, so the black woman explained to her, she's like, you know, there's a history of black people being accused of not paying their bills and not tipping. And, you know, and they're careful to not get angry because there's the stigma of being an angry black person. And so she said, there are certain things, like when I go to a restaurant and I get food, or if I place an order and it doesn't come in time and all the people around me are getting it and I'm not, basically I'm being ignored and it comes late and it's cold and all this stuff. She's like, then do I have to decide, do I tip? Because if I don't tip, they're just going to blame it on the fact that I'm black, but I got terrible service.
Right. So, no, I saw this. And not only did I see it, I know I can actually, just to let you know how much I clearly watch this show, it was Kyle and Garcelle.
Thank you. I always forget names.
But what was fascinating about that, so I don't know if you saw, you know, on the last episode when this came up, and Kyle, to her credit, seemed to take to heart Garcelle had said. At first, she was stunned by it because she had that typical reaction of like, oh, my God, I never thought of that.
Yeah.
But then you could see that she's like, oh, shit, I never thought of that. Right.
Yeah.
But then in the latest episode that I saw, it was fascinating to watch one of the other quote unquote Real Housewives, which I, by the way, like, I don't know any housewives that are like any
exactly.
Like, this is the weirdest thing I've ever seen in my life. But in any event, one of the other ones, Sutton, you know, like loses her mind at the mere conversation about race. Like, she starts crying. It's like they were, you know, this episode of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills brought to you by White Fragility.
Exactly.
Like this episode is, you know, like it was a corporate sponsor.
Yeah.
You know, and she starts crying at the mere discussion of this brought to her attention by one of the other castmates who is Asian, who you know, says to her, hey, do you realize it's Crystal, brings up, you know, are you going to be that white woman that says, I don't see color? And then, of course, Sutton's like, well, yes, that is me. You know, and you're just sort of watching it going, oh, dear God.
Yeah.
Like, this is really, like, even the most seemingly basic point which mm-hmm. Garcelle was trying to make, which is I have to think about stuff you don't.
Right.
And then Crystal basically saying the same thing, mm-hmm. right? Like, I have to think about stuff you don't. And there's Kyle who's sort of like, yeah, that's really deep and I need to think about that. And I mean, on the one hand, it's sort of pathetic. She hasn't ever thought about that right. before, but whatever. Like, all right.
She's in her bubble. Whenever you
come, it's fine. You come to the dance late, no mm-hmm. big deal. But for God's sake, do not tell the DJ to play your music. Like,
right.
like you need to, you know, just dance to whatever the hell's being played. And Kyle seemed ready to do that, and Sutton's like, well, hell no, and then made it about her, and is it because I'm from the South, y'all think I'm racist, mm-hmm. and then it became all about her feelings, which again is, I think, a very typical deflection that white folks do, and not just white right-wingers, you know, white liberals,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know Sutton's politics at all, but I mean, you know, my guess is that most of the time the people who react that way are the ones who do say, you know, but I've got all these black friends and I love everybody. And look, I'm not somebody who wants to entirely dismiss that personal connection that people sometimes really do have. Like I said, it is important. It is part of why I am who I am and the reason that I view the world the way I view it. But I also realize that personal connection I had to those kids that I mentioned earlier on the show did not protect them as they grew up. It did not, you know, me being buddies with all those black kids that went out to Jolton to play baseball in 1980 and standing up for them and being there with them as we were, you know, surrounded and being yelled at by these white kids, that, you know, that didn't get my friends a house loan when they were 40.
Yeah.
You know, that didn't, I mean, I wasn't there at the bank for them. Actually, my presence wouldn't have helped them, because like I said, my credit by that time was awful. but you know, I'm not there when the cop pulls them over, you know, for being in the wrong neighborhood, quote unquote. So even when you do have the personal connection, there's still shit happening that you have no idea about.
Mm-hmm.
And part of breaking the habit of white supremacy is coming to have the kind of humility that allows you to say, man, there is some shit that I just don't understand.
Yeah.
And that I'm never going to understand. And so the best way to deal with it is to trust that the people who do actually deal with it every day are not hallucinating.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they haven't actually lost their mind. Like, they actually are rational enough to discern their reality. And that may seem like such a basic concept, but if it were as basic as it seems, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in, because white folks would be like, man, I should probably listen to black people. And men would be like, man, I should probably listen to women.
Yeah.
And straight and cisgendered folk would be like, maybe I should shut up and listen to LGBTQ folk, right? Like, we would have that humility, but we live in a culture that generally doesn't encourage humility.
Yeah.
And it especially does not encourage humility among the more dominant social and cultural groups.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm glad to see that there are some characters on that show that are not white. It's good to see that, because it was something that I thought, geez, man, every freaking season, it's all white women. And, you know, I mean, especially in the OC, like I was saying, they really hold up the patriarchy down there. Even though there are some successful women on their own, they're still perpetuating patriarchy. But Here's a perfect example, and I don't remember if I brought this up to you before, if I even had the conversation, but I spoke with the comedy duo Frangela. Both women are black, and you know, I'm a white person, and I have my white privilege, and there's a little bit of the bubble. I try to understand as best I can, and I've talked to black people, and I've gone out with black men, and I've had, you know, that's not to say that, oh, pat me on the back, I'm so special. But I mean, I do try to make an effort to understand. But there are certain things that I can just never understand. Like, for instance, one of the women of that duo, Frangela, and I'm so bad with names, so just pardon me, I can't remember which one, which name. This woman was saying that she had been on a job interview and was asked by the white male who was interviewing her, if she knew who her father was.
Yeah, right.
And I mean, as much as I could imagine, you know, black people, especially black women, having to endure constant racism, whether it's, you know, angry and an accusatory type of racism, or if it's just, you know, passive and it's just that never in a million years would have occurred to me. And I know that it was one of them who also said that when they were also on a job interview, this woman had kids, and the white guy interviewing her asked if the father was around, not even knowing if they were still a couple. You know, and it's like, so there, the things that black people have to experience in this country, some of the things as a white person who feels like, okay, I think I understand to a degree and I want to understand more, would never even occur to you, the stuff that they have to go through. And it's really unbelievable. You know, it's just, and so, like, you know, going back to the Housewives, it's funny to me that you watch it, and I know more men watch it than admit to, and it is embarrassing to admit, because it's just.
I mean, like, it's just, well, I look at all of everything I watch on Bravo, I watch as a sociological experience. It's all like, because it is fascinating. And, you know, and I knew growing up as someone on the left, I mean, I was always, you know, surrounded by people who just like wanted nothing to do with popular culture. It was just like, you know, oh, I'm not going to let my kids watch TV and kill your television, and I'm not going to watch any Disney films and let my kids, you know, because it's all evil. But, you know, the reality is, if you want to have a critique of the modern world and you want to have a critique of modern popular culture, but you're not actually familiar with it, then what is your critique based on? It's really no different than those right wingers who think everything is sinful, but they never read the book that they're critiquing. They never saw the movie that they're critiquing, but they're going to say that it's vile and lewd and pornographic and blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, it's like, no, I'm going to watch those things. Now, I do have my limit. Like, actually, I just can't watch OC. I'll be honest. Like, I can't
watch OC. I
don't
blame
you. I can't, because first of all, anyone who knows Orange County knows that that's only OC, like, as it was 30 years ago. Orange County has, like, the largest Vietnamese community outside of Vietnam, of, like, anywhere in, well, or outside of other parts of Southeast Asia than anywhere else in the world. But you wouldn't know that by watching that show. So I do watch Beverly Hills because it's fascinating.
It is.
I do watch Atlanta and Potomac, because which I called Bethesda earlier because I'm confusing my, but you know, it's the I-95, it's the Beltway corridor, people. I do watch Potomac because it's not white centric in that regard. And I do watch New Jersey because I like to see tables get flipped. And I watch New York, you know, because that's a train wreck also. But so basically, yeah, I do consume all of this and I take it with a grain of salt, and sometimes it makes me a little nuts, but I do think that you do see these moments of that are actually really valuable, like to be able to point to that exchange that we just talked about between Kyle and Garcelle and then Sutton and Crystal is actually like, if that's the stuff that millions of people are watching.
Yes.
And that allows me to say, like, oh, here's what we mean by white fragility, or here's what we mean by, you know, the power of whiteness and the invisibility of white privilege. Like, I can give you, you know, a bunch of other sort of academic and scholarly examples, which may or may not land, or I can say, hey, watch this clip from this popular television show that you already watch, and let's talk about it. And which of those things you think is going to be more impactful? Right. Probably the Real Housewives discussion.
That's so true. So. It's so true. And I mean, Sutton's reaction. I mean, she just was like, no, we're not going to. I mean, she was so hardcore.
She's like, I can't even go there.
Yeah.
And you're just sort of like, wait. And then when it became all about being a Southerner, and as a Southerner, you know, I just look at that and my eyes like roll permanently around in the back of my head, because, you know, the reality is, if you've got a complex about being a Southerner, that's on you, you know, and I get it, because I used to have that. I used to be so concerned about how we were viewed in the set, because there was a time when I was so insistent, like I wanted you to know I was different, right? I wanted you to know that I wasn't like that, and so I would try to like stifle any inkling of a Southern accent that I had. And I don't have a really heavy one compared to most, but I mean, it'll come out, and I used to fight it. I used to fight it like really vociferously, because I didn't want, and then I was like, wait a minute, what is that bullshit? Because here's the reality. You know, if you want to look at the history of white allies to the anti-racism struggle. I'm talking during the civil rights movement. I'm talking during the abolitionist struggle and even the colonial period. The vast majority of those white allies came from the South. I mean, it was Ann Braden and Carl Braden, and it was Bob Zellner, and it was, you know, Virginia Foster Dyer, and it was people that were in the South. So what is it I'm ashamed of? There's this alternative Southern tradition, which I'm sure Sutton knows nothing about. and that allows her to think that, well, everybody must view us as, you know, slave owners and segregationists. Well, if they do, that's their that's wrong for them to do. But it's partly because we in the South have not held up our actual heroes and sheroes. We haven't actually said, no, these are the white people that we want to be like. You know, instead, we want to keep, you know, we don't have statues to Ann Braden and Virginia Foster Dyer and white abolitionists from the South. You know, John Fee, who was a abolitionist minister who was literally defrocked from his congregation because he refused to minister to slaveholders. I mean, you know, the only place you'll find a statue of him is on the campus of Berea College, which he founded. But you're not going to see him, you know, like enshrined elsewhere. Why? Why do we have statues to a bunch of Confederates and we don't have statues to white abolitionists and we don't have statues? Well, you know the answer. The answer is we have made a choice, but we made that choice. And so if Sutton doesn't like the impact of that choice, then Sutton needs to get her ass out of Orange County, not Orange County, get her ass out of Beverly Hills, come on back to Charlotte or wherever the hell she's from, and fight for a different kind of Southern image of a white person.
Yeah.
Because otherwise she has nothing to offer this conversation other than her tears.
Yeah. And she, oh God, she stressed me nuts. I don't like her. But that was an amazing exchange. And I was actually kind of happy to see it just because it's always been like all white women. And now they're, you know, I'm grateful that they're introducing more diversity into that show. And like you said, because it's pop culture, because so many, and you know what? I know more men watch it than they admit. And and I'm sure women, more women watch. I mean, it's a little bit easier for women to admit, but it's embarrassing to admit it because it, I mean, it's a soap opera, but it is a social experiment. And it is, even though, like, for instance, another show that I like to watch and I find fascinating, and my boyfriend and I watch it, it's called Little People, Big World. And it's about this. So the parents are dwarves, and then they have, I think, five kids, but one, they had a set of twins, and one of the twins is a dwarf, and then his brother isn't, and then the rest of the kids are normal size. And so, you know, it's like when you watch this show, even though some of the things they make them do are contrived, the relationships are not, and the and a lot of the conversations that they have, those are genuine. But they'll create an event just to have something for everybody to be involved in, and you know, but those feelings, the fights, the conversations that they have are all real. And I think it's also beneficial because when, you know, I mean, I've pretty much seen all the shows now, and it's been on forever, for I don't know how many seasons, but it's the kids, they were kids when it started, and now they're married and have they have their own kids. So it's a lot of time that show's been on the air. And I know not everybody watches it, but for everybody who does watch it, it's like you start, it's like dwarves become normalized. It's not even an issue, because I know when dwarves are out and about and they're doing their thing, they get a lot of stares. People stare at them, and they, you know, they also, which I didn't even know, like go pick them up. They were talking about how like people just pick them up. Oh my God. I was like,
no, It's so awful. No, I mean, I do think that in spite of how contrived reality TV can be, and it can be, and there's obviously when you watch Real Housewives or any of the other shows, you know, there's certain aspects of real life that are sort of soap and all. They don't make for good TV. And so you know that there's a certain degree of not scripting, but like, you know, creating storylines and creating some drama, or there's clever editing. And we know that happens on all of these shows. But that doesn't mean that the underlying messages and the value of a show like that isn't real.
Right.
Like the fact that all of a sudden, you know, you start to see entire groups of people as fully human and which is absurd that you didn't in the first place. But the reality is when people are invisible, you don't view them as fully human. You just don't, you know, whether that's on the basis of class, whether that's on the basis of race, whether that's on the basis of sexuality, whether that's on the basis of stature, whether that's on the basis of some disability, whether that's on the basis of, I mean, whatever it is, right? And so I think that there is a service that is done by this stuff. And yeah. so we have to, I think sometimes people on the left and progressive people are so quick to sort of, you know, eschew popular culture and it's all just capitalist money-making BS.
Right.
Yeah, it is that, but it's also a reflection of the society. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking about this a lot in the last several months because, you know, the very first real sort of reality show, The Real World, had mm-hmm. their, you know, big yes. reunion for the first season. And I know a couple of the people from that season and several other seasons. I'm friends with Kevin Powell. And there was this real, you know, this, I don't know if you saw the reunion episodes this year, but like there was this real, I mean, basically the storyline was Kevin was right the whole time.
Yes.
Right. Because
yes.
what he said back in 1992 about racism being this monstrous force in America, which some of his roommates just could not hear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was during the Rodney the Rodney King beating, or the trial based on the Rodney King beating, and the uprising that took place in LA afterward. And yet his roommates couldn't hear it. And 30 years later, it was like, well, damn,
yeah.
you know, Kevin was right. And mm-hmm. so the question is, was some of that stuff from the real world contrived? Sure. Kevin will tell you there were, you know, things about it that weren't nearly as real as it seemed when mm-hmm. it first aired. But you know what? I think it changed the culture for the better because it introduced mm-hmm. a lot of people to that thinking about the importance of racism, even mm-hmm. even if it was in the guise of this supposedly angry black man, which was really messed up for them to cast him that way,
right.
or to view him that way, or to portray him that way. And I'm sure at the time that I know for a fact from having talked to Kevin that was not a good experience for him because mm-hmm. he had to catch hell for years and yeah. years and years. But here we are finally having this realization and this reckoning and this ability to look back now and see the video footage, right? Because Kevin yeah. could have been having that conversation with random people without a camera around and there would be no archive of it.
Yeah.
There would be no educational value to it. But now we can actually look back and go, oh shit, he said that in 1992. Now let's look at what was going on then and what's going on now. And it becomes an educational tool.
Yeah.
And so as much as we might want to say, oh, it's all contrived, you know, pop culture bullshit, the reality is we consume that stuff.
Yeah.
And so we can either use it as a tool or not. But mm-hmm. it's like any tool, like a hammer can build a house or it can bash your head in. Right.
Yeah.
So it's how you use the tool. It's not the tool itself, which is the problem.
Right. And, you know, going back to that capitalist thing, I mean, when you go to shows like The Cosby Show, which, of course, Cosby just turned out to be the worst horrible person.
Yeah, right.
But before that all happened, his show was incredibly it wasn't just The Cosby Show, because Bill Cosby, there were cartoons. He was a huge part of our culture, obviously
yeah.
beloved, and we didn't know that he was a serial rapist. But yeah. take the serial rapist out of it just for a minute and look at the cultural impact. And for me, a white kid growing up in the 80s, I feel that we've talked about this before. I felt that I was fortunate because in some instances, I too was one of the lone white people in school. So I was never singled out for being white. I was never made
yeah.
to feel bad for it, but I did get that experience where yeah. some white people just their whole lives, they go to school with white people and they don't know any different. So,
yeah.
and you know, my mother was always somebody who talked about equality and tolerance, and so that was always in my life. And then I would watch a show like The Cosby Show or Designing Women or any of these shows
yeah.
that promoted the idea that of diversity in any way. And
right.
it, you know, I mean, they were extremely important because they did show America, look, a black family can be incredibly successful and educated and, you know, a positive thing.
Well, and there, yeah. Now there was. I do want to mention this. There was a very interesting downside to that, which I do want to point out. So
okay.
yes, it was really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
There was, however, a study that was done by a couple of professors, one of whom is a good friend of mine at UMass, that looked at the effect of The Cosby Show on white viewer attitudes. Now,
mm-hmm.
This wouldn't have been an issue for you or for me or for other white folks who were also around black people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for a lot of white folks, it had this effect. What they did is they had these focus groups, and they talked to these white viewers, people who loved, you know, the Cosby Show. And it was mm-hmm. one of the few shows that crossed over racially yeah. in those days. Like most of the time, the other shows, you know, were either black shows, quote unquote, or white shows. Quote,
right.
Unquote, right. And that was one of the few that had crossover. Well, what they discovered was that the thing that white folks apparently really liked about Cosby was that because the Huxtables were this, you know, successful doctor, lawyer team, upper middle class family, they could very easily identify with them, but it reinforced this other belief, which is problematic, which is, well, if the Huxtables can make it, why can't everybody make
there
it?
You right? go.
Like
right.
it actually reinforced the notion of meritocracy and rugged individualism. Now, if you actually were around real black people, you would know better than to assume one-dimensional stereotypes, good or bad, are true. Like you would know better. But if you didn't, right, if the only black people you knew were the Huxtables, you could be like, oh, finally, black people I can relate to, unlike Good Times, unlike the Jeffersons, unlike, which actually, to be honest, Good Times and the Jeffersons and All in the Family and those shows were considerably better on the issue of race.
They were,
and actually confronting Sanford and Son and all those shows considerably better and more cutting edge, but because the black people in those shows were working class, or even, or you know, in the case of the Evanses, I mean, they lived in public housing in Chicago. I mean, you know, it's like, so a lot of white folks watched that show, but they couldn't really relate to this family. And so now here come the Huxtables, and it's like, oh, the American dream really does work. So there is a downside, but again, the value of the Cosby Show existing, and then the value of Good Times and these other shows existing is we can then take those snippets of popular culture and talk about, and they become pedagogical tools. That becomes an actual textbook, right? That becomes something we can look at and say to an audience, hey, why is it that you related so well to the Huxtables, but when the show, I don't know if you remember the show Rock, but when Rock came on,
which I remember.
Was Charles Dutton, this brilliant stage actor who's since passed, but I think, I hope I haven't just written him I think Charles Dutton died several years ago. Brilliant stage actor who did this television show, and it was a great show, and it lasted like one season. Well, what was the difference? It was on at the same time Roseanne was on, and Roseanne was big. Roseanne was working class, you know, working class white folks. Rock was working class. He was like the head of the sanitation department or whatever in Philly or whatever town it was. And but white folks didn't watch Rock. It was at least as well written as Roseanne, if not better. But we couldn't relate, apparently, to like working class, average, everyday black people. You know, they had to be the doctor and the lawyer.
Right.
They, you know, the white folks could be as dysfunctional as that. You know, working class, they could be married with children, was like the most dysfunctional family in the history of television. Like, I remember one episode, I watched one episode of that. And all I remember was like the Bundys were eating snow cones made with mouthwash because they couldn't afford syrup or something. I mean, like, what? Like that, like working class people don't do that.
No.
Like this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. But white folks were like, oh, I can't wait to watch that show.
I know.
But you can't watch Rock. It's like, what? You know?
Wow.
It's bizarre. Or you can watch Friends, but you didn't watch Living Single.
Yeah, which I loved Living
what
Single.
What Friends was based on.
Yeah.
You know, was actually stolen from that show.
Yeah.
So
and that was a good show.
It was a very good show, but I think popular culture is a really good tool that we can use. Sometimes the usefulness of it isn't obvious right away.
Yeah.
Like it may take years for us to go, oh my God, look at that. But that's why it is important for progressives, if they're going to have a critique, like you need to know what's being said and what people are ingesting, because then you can refer back to it and say, like, you know, it's really hard to critique the Disney film that you didn't see. You know, it's really hard to critique the television show that you're too precious to watch, you know, because you're watching your documentary on the Sundance channel or whatever.
Right.
Like, and by the way, like I watch those too, but like right now I'm binge watching The Practice, you know, which was like my favorite show in the 90s. And it's fascinating how many interesting, you know, things come up on that show that you realize 20 some odd years later, oh, wow, okay, this is the same shit that we're still dealing with. So I think there's a real, you know, need for progressive people to really think critically about popular culture and how to use it rather than just sort of turning our nose up at it like it's all just dirty or something. You
know? Yeah, that's a great point. Well, before we go, I do want to touch on one more thing, because I saw you, that you would, I think you were retweeted it, and someone posted a video of you talking about the white guilt versus responsibility.
Yeah.
So I just want you to kind of go over that, because I thought that you made an incredibly good point. And there are these questions now, especially now lately, people coming up and, you know, white people saying, why do I have to feel guilty about right. what my ancestors did when I didn't do it? So, like, I just want right. you to kind of say what you said.
Well, I mean, the thing that, you know, and I've said this for a very long time, I said it in, you know, in my first book, White Like Me, that, you know, the difference between guilt and responsibility is, you know, guilt is what you feel for the stuff that you've actually done. Mm-hmm. And responsibility is something that grownups take because of the kind of people that they are. Mm-hmm. And even non-grownups can. I mean, you know, and maybe not as good at it as others, but that it's something we take because we want to be accountable to the world as we find it. And mm-hmm. so I'm fully aware of how old modern day white people are not. I realize they did not establish the slave system. I realize mm-hmm. they are not old enough to have established the system of segregation, but we inherit the legacy of everything that has come before us. I am sitting right now in a house on land that used to be someone else's land. And that land was taken by force from indigenous peoples who lived in the Nashville area long before my family came here. And so I've inherited, quote unquote, the legacy of that conquest. If I am going to inherit the ability, the upside of someone else's actions, mm-hmm. that is to say the opportunities created by that, the wealth, not that I am wealthy, but the relative wealth that I have or that others have, then fine. But I have to also accept that I've inherited the downside of mm-hmm. that. If I inherit the benefits, I also inherit the deficits. And if you think of it, you know, this isn't really a radical idea if you thought about it in any other context. Like if you were to say, you know, that you think about pollution, right? Like I don't know anyone personally who has their own supply of toxic chemicals that they inject into the soil or that they go dump into the rivers. Mm-hmm. I don't know anyone who has their own smokestack where they, like, you know, pump out all these heavy metals into the air and cause acid rain or whatever. Like, right. I don't know anyone who does that. But the reality is all of that stuff has been done, yeah. and it's been done for the purpose of modernity and economic progress and, you know, the development of great riches. So the question is, are we guilty for, you know, the state of the ecology? Not directly, but are we going to be responsible mm-hmm. and do something? Well, I certainly hope so, because yeah. if not, we are continuing the pattern of damage. It's like if you become the CEO of a corporation, you can't walk in on the first day and tell your chief financial officer, hey, look, you know, I know we have all these debts that we, you know, racked up, taking out loans and stuff, but listen, I wasn't here and I didn't take right. out those loans. And and so that was that other CEO. You really should have had him pay it or her pay it. But yeah. but now that I'm here, I'm just going to use all the assets. Mm-hmm. I'm going to use all the revenue. Oh yeah. I'm going to make use of the revenue stream y'all had before I walked in, mm-hmm. but I'm not going to pay the debt. That's not responsible. Mm-hmm. And so this isn't about guilt or shame. Guilt and shame are unproductive. They've mm-hmm. never liberated anyone mm-hmm. from anything. When you feel guilt and shame, the only thing that you want is to get rid of it. Yeah. And the easiest way to get rid of it is just to walk away from whatever's making you feel shitty.
Yeah.
And so if you want people to change the world, you can't have them walk away from making change because the work makes them feel bad. You have to say, listen, this is not your fault, but it is your responsibility. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it in all the other ways that we try to, you know, it's like most of us come from dysfunctional families, whether we acknowledge it or not. Some of us, you know, some of us are more than willing to acknowledge it. I'm in therapy and I'm real clear. I'm mm-hmm. real clear on the dysfunction. But as a result, what do I learn in therapy? I learn that I've inherited the legacy of all the bullshit that went down before me. Mm-hmm. And I could sit there in therapy and be like, well, it's not my fault. Well, it's not my fault I acted like an asshole. I come from a long line of assholes. Like, that's not
yeah,
the answer,
right.
right? That's not, it's like, I'm not to blame for what my dad did. No, but if I inherit some of the bullshit and carry on some of the dysfunction, like, well, then I gotta, you know, like, it's like, do you want to just be an adult or do you want right. to just keep making excuses? Yeah. And I think that what white America's learned to do over the years is just pass the buck and kick the can. And every generation has said the same thing. Every generation has said, well, it wasn't my fault. It was the last generation. But then the two generations later says that it was you. And then three generations later says it was two generations before. And so at some point, like, we just keep going around and around and around and nothing gets solved. And so if you really want to, you know, if white people really want to stop feeling bad, there's a really great way to do that. Get on board this movement for racial justice and equity, and you don't have to feel shitty ever again. You'll be fighting for a different world that doesn't constantly remind you of injustice. Because we won't have injustice. How about that? If we didn't have injustice, then you wouldn't have to sweat feeling shitty about injustice. That seems to be the most direct route to fix the problem, right?
Wow. God, talking to you is always so great. You're just this fountain of knowledge. And I like how you, I'm glad that our conversation went into some pop culture, because it's true that whether that's a good thing or not, that is something we all kind of, whether or not you watch the show we were discussing, doesn't really matter. It's just the idea of pop culture influences how we think, and it can have a much more, a bigger impact, I should say, then maybe, like you were saying, something academic, which doesn't feel personal to you, but pop culture does, because you're emotionally invested in it. So I'm glad we got to talk about that. But before you go, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you?
Well, that's always a loaded question with me, because I get, as I told you before, you had to tell me what your phone number was going to be before you called me, because I get hate calls and I always, I don't know the number, I ain't answering it. So I'm not going to tell people where they can find me. Sadly, some Nazis have made that all too noble already, but I will say this, online folks can find me obviously on Twitter at Tim Jacob Wise. They can also find me on Facebook. The main Facebook page is also, I think, findable under at Tim Jacob Wise. My Medium articles, which is the main place that I post longer essays, can be found under my name at Medium. And I have a website that has like old archive stuff at timwise.org, but I haven't updated it in years. But you can find some old stuff there. And those are the main places. Obviously, my books are on Amazon or from the publishers. Well, my two main publishers are City Lights and Soft Skull Counterpunch. Counterpoint. And the latest book, Dispatches from the Race War, which is an essay collection, is available from City Lights directly, or you can get it at, you know, whatever bookstores you shop at, or online at whatever place you get your books. My Patreon is Speak Out with Tim Wise on Patreon. So folks who want to get some audio essays, I got a lot of stuff archived. I haven't been real good about posting stuff lately, but I'm going to get back in the habit of doing that. So if you want to support that, you can do that there. And I think, you know, that's it. That's all the good places to find me. I don't Instagram yet, and I don't TikTok, so you're not going to find me on those places. But
I do Instagram, but I don't TikTok either. Well, I did put your Patreon, I think your website, and your Twitter handle in the Patreon description of this show. So if anybody wants to go to it quick, you can find it there. You can also find me on Twitter at Author Kimberly, KimberLey. Don't forget that extra E. And then my books are also on Amazon. And I would just like to say, if you do get one of my books or Tim's books and you read them and you like them, authors need reviews. We always need reviews. And so I also, same thing for podcasts. So just FYI, everybody. But anyway, Tim, thank you so much for coming back. It was so great talking to you.
Oh, you bet. You too.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.